It is time now to continue our series on the history of our forests. It's produced by retired Aiken County Land Commissioner Mark Jacobs. And today we're going to learn about pre-settlement wildlife with retired DNR non-game wildlife scientist, correct? Am I saying that right? Bill Berg.
Yes.
Am I getting that right?
I think so.
Mark and Bill are joining me now. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I really wasn't a non-game in the non-game section.
You were
but
the
I was
game.
A wildlife research biologist.
There we go.
With DNR and the Forest Wildlife Group in Grand Rapids, and retired in quotes in 2001. And I remember a lot of fun times on the radio with Harry and John, and really fun times. Looking forward to this morning.
Oh, I am too, Bill. It's good to hear your voice again.
Yeah.
I think fondly of. Of the three of us and Scott Hall jammed into that studio at the college.
Yeah, but they were really, really good times, and we covered a lot of subjects, and we told the truth most of the time.
When it was to our benefit, yeah, we did.
Yeah.
So Mark, let's set the stage for us. Why did you want to talk to Bill? Give us an idea of what this topic is.
Well, a number of years ago, I was at a Wildlife Society meeting in Brainerd area, and Bill gave this presentation about journals he'd referenced and talked about what, you know, centuries ago, what the wildlife species were in the area. And I think everyone in the room was pretty well surprised by it, or most people. And I thought it'd be an interesting topic for our listeners.
Yeah, you know, it was pre-COVID times. And Minnesota Wildlife Society chapter has usually two meetings a year, one in the summer and one in the winter. And the one in the winter is really a big one. But the one during that particular summer, like, what, 5 years ago, I'm not sure, that was really a good one. And it was really an important one. And we had not just a lot of wildlifers there, but a lot of foresters there. And we had a number of presentations by a lot of retired folks from DNR and from a couple other agencies who have an interest in history and who have somewhat complete memories, you know, and it was fun.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, Mark, you mentioned those journals. Bill, can you tell us more about them, when they were written?
Well, you know, there were all kinds of them, written by a number of different authors. A lot of them were during the 1800s and early 1900s. Our old late friend Aldo Leopold from Wisconsin was one of the premier authors of some of these, and then there were some of them. Some of the old fur posts kept really good records in these old fur posts, scattered all over the state, not just the north, surprisingly. And so a couple of those records have survived, like, almost intact. And so there were some tremendous changes in wildlife through, like, the late 1700s, through the 1800s, and into the early 1900s. And some of these changes, you know, persist to the day, really. And, like, one is a dramatic change in the range of big game. Like, caribou were really abundant during all the time before white man came, before European settlement, and which was a period that extended all the way through early 1800s, all the way into early 1900s, really. And of course, caribou are gone from it. They're gone from Minnesota now, and most likely never to come back. And so that was really a dynamic one. There were moose scattered all over the northern half of the state back then. Surprisingly, to a lot of people listening, essentially no deer. And the reason is the forests were pretty old. There were deer where there were disturbances like wind, fire, floods, surprisingly. that sets succession back. If you are a lower succession species where they like young grasslands, brush and trees and so forth, and there were wolves scattered all over the state, according to these old fur buyer records, all the way into southern Minnesota, and bounded wolves. Surprisingly, the oldest game law in Minnesota was in 1849. I think it was 1848, and the same law extended until 1965. And that was, some listeners might guess it, a bounty law, where literally everything that was considered bad wildlife, bad game, was bountied. Everything from wolves, fox, coyotes, bobcats, lynx, pocket gophers, snakes, you name it. And everything that was considered bad wildlife was bountied till 1965, when DNR repealed that law.
Incredible. Bill, excuse me, were there birds on that? Were there raptors, bounties paid for them as well? I know that lots of farmers shot lots of hawks and owls because they assumed that they were taking their chickens.
Yeah, in fact, I tell you what, that law also ended with that, I think, the 1965, maybe right around there anyhow. But I have, I had old friends who I kept coyotes and so forth with, who still had such a dislike for raptors, mainly hawks and owls, that they were still putting up posts with traps. So, a raptor would land on a post looking for mice or something. And so, believe it or not, yeah, they were still killed by a lot of people back then, and it included all hawks and owls. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember some of that, and distressed that would still persist.
Oh, yeah.
So, talking about, you mentioned caribou being pretty predominant wildlife up here before settlement. Did they extend into the prairies at all? Was there territory in the prairies at all?
Not at all.
So they were
a northern species even way, way back then. They're a lichen feeder. Lichens are those things that hang from spruce and pine trees, mainly spruce, in the bogs. They were a bog critter. Their feet were made to walk in bogs in the soft critter, or in the soft soft ground. And so they were basically a northern critter when way before white man came. There were a lot of them. Like in the northeast, these were all woodland caribou, by the way, and non-migratory. Basically, they were non-migratory. But in the northeast, there were a lot of caribou, a few moose, no deer, a smattering of elk, but not many. In the northwest, there were a lot more caribou in the big bogs, like north of Upper Red Lake, and in the Pine Island bogs east of Highway 72 going to Bedette, and west of 72 going up to Bedette. And you can still walk out in those bogs wherever you can walk. You have to have bog shoes or bear paw snowshoes, something like that, and see these giant, wide, deep woodland caribou trails. And they extended north up to Lake of the Woods, and then they split. Some going around the east side, and some going around the west side of Lake of the Woods. And caribou were really vulnerable to predation. I want to say they're not very smart, but they're really smart. They evolved in low predator numbers, and their predator strategy, anti-predator strategy, is to get on an island. A cow would get on an island and give birth, and that's where their young would also learn to go on an island and give birth. And so they were gone. There were still a handful of wild caribou packs or herds in the 1920s, surprisingly, but then they became totally gone, exterminated, and so there was DNR, the old Department of Conservation, together with the CCC, the Brazil administration, they tried to reintroduce caribou in that big bog country north of Upper Red Lake. And they had a big nursery pen and a giant pen that kept their herd in. They were up to about 30, 35 animals. And high mortality back then. Finally, they just had to let them go. And back then, and deer numbers were really good, really rising, even in the big bog, because that even the big bog in northern Minnesota had high settlement by homesteaders. And that brought in, and of course, together with the logging, you know, virtually everything came down. Old forest was converted to young forest in just a matter of a couple, three or four decades, really, you know. So the other critters kind of took a hit, really took a hit. Caribou did, and moose took a hit, and elk certainly took a hit. And deer came, and the caribou introduction did make it. That was back in the 30s.
Yeah, so incredible. So I know that there's a relationship between deer and moose, and that the deer have a disease that they transfer to moose, a brain worm that affects the moose and doesn't affect the deer. Was there anything like that between deer and caribou?
Very much so.
Yeah.
In fact, caribou are more vulnerable to that than our deer, and it's a brain worm, and it's a thickness of a kind of a heavy human hair, a thick human hair, so most deer carry it, and it's fatal to moose. It goes through a moose and deer dropping and upland snail process. Pretty hard to eat some branches or leaves without ingesting some, you know, leaves from that contain those upland snails and slugs. And so caribou are even more vulnerable to that particular disease than our moose. So that's the reason that wherever caribou existed and deer came in, that was just about the end of the caribou.
Uh-huh. Say, yeah. I want to change focus just really quickly here. Beaver was, the rage for the reason Hudson's Bay Company even got started was that beaver, the hair of the beaver pelt, was made into a felt that made hats, and hats were a big thing in Europe in those days.
Yeah.
And so there was a great demand for beaver. What was that population like?
Well, back in the Voyager days, you know, the Voyagers and the early trappers, by the way, there were like, I have records of 132 fur posts in all of Minnesota, which is just blows you away, you know. Hudson's Bay American fur. But so the Voyagers were not conservationists. The fur posts were not conservationists. So when the Voyager trappers came in via the rivers, via Lake Superior, over into the towards Lake Kenora and so forth, and from the western prairies, it's hard to say this, you know, given no transportation, given no communications at all, they pretty much wiped them out. And it's hard to believe that. But, you know, there were so many fur posts. They were after every fur they could get. Most of the furs were brought back to the Great Lakes or shipped to Europe somehow. And they pretty much wiped the beaver out. It's hard to believe something like that. That could happen back in those early days with, you know, poor transportation. They had birch bark canoes and everything. But they did. They pretty much wiped them out. Some of the records from those fur posts show absolutely incredible numbers of beavers that were brought in and salted. And remember, no refrigeration. And so they were, simple to say, they were not conservationists, and they were after every fur they effort to get. They were after every dollar they could get, and so they pretty much wiped them out. And interestingly enough, in the late 40s and early 50s, county road crews and DNR and so forth can be surprised at this, but we, conservation department back in those days, actually stocked live-trapped beaver here and there and stocked beaver because they were so low in numbers. And now, of course, there's beaver everywhere, you know, flooding road ditches, causing damage, you know, here and there, and flooding ponds and so forth where they never were before. And but we actually, especially in the northwestern part, like in the old ditched country, that the ditch country that was created back in the 20s and 30s for homesteading, we actually restocked beaver at just some incredible stories went on back then, and live trapped them someplace and moved them someplace else. You know,
Bill, yeah. was this trapping done in as it is now in the fall when the furs are prime, or was it just you see a beaver you grabbed it, didn't matter if it was summer, winter?
It was pretty much the latter, you know. But there's different, even today, different fur buyers will buy different furs.
Right.
And, you know, and during the fall beaver season, beaver pelts have a lot of long fur with very little under fur. And during the spring, the long fur, they're getting ready for the warmer water or whatever, and they lose that long fur, and they have tremendous thick under fur. And so there's really two markets for that. And so the fur laws, the animal taking laws, you know, were literally non-existent. And the fur posts themselves were actually permitted by, you know, there was no Department of Conservation back then, the early ones, by the Department of War gave the fur posts their trapping permit or their fur buyer permit.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a really interesting little publication. I got it from Minnesota Historical Society years ago. It's called Post in Minnesota Fur Trading 1660. Imagine that,
yeah.
1855.
Yeah.
And it's available online, really. You go to Minnesota Historical Society and get it, by Grace Lee Newt, N-U-T-E. But it details all these fur posts all over the state, not just north. Surprisingly, number of fur posts in central Minnesota, Twin Cities, southwest, southeastern Minnesota, that, you know, like big ones, like all over the state. Like Grand Rapids had a big one at Pocagama Falls. There was a really huge fur post at Sandy Lake, where the Mississippi, you know, goes by the Sandy Lake. And one building still stands on private property, of course, now. One building still remains of that original fur post at Sandy Lake. There were a lot of fur posts on the North Shore, predominantly up around, you know, Grand Marais and Grand Portage. And coming down from Winnipeg, big fur posts by Babette and Warroad. And just scattered all over. All of them made little money, and they'd be built for a couple, 3 or 4 years, and, you know, just kind of abandoned here and there.
Yeah. Bill, as always, man, I could talk to you all day. I've got 1,000 more questions.
Time just flies.
It does.
And we could do it again.
Let's do that.
So much more, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's have another conversation soon. Mark?
Good.
It's your show. Anything to add?
Well, one of the things that really struck the group during your presentation was basically there are less wolves than there are now in the state of Minnesota. Can you elaborate on that?
If I was going to guess, I'd say that, you know, back then wolves were distributed statewide from south or from north to south. Low numbers in the north because there were no deer, you know, and so there were a lot of deer, more deer anyhow, in southern Minnesota. So there were wolves. I was looking at old bounty records, and they still exist too. All of southern Minnesota bountied wolves way up until like maybe 1900, a little bit after, you know. So we might have the same statewide wolf population now, but they're much higher in northern Minnesota. And there are zero wolves, of course, in southern Minnesota. Once in a while, on streets down there, you know. But, it's pretty incredible that we have a lot of wolves in northern Minnesota. Probably the most dense wolf population of anywhere in North America. I can almost guarantee you that. And deer hunters don't like to hear that. Trappers don't like to hear it, really, but that's what it is. So a lot of people want more deer, and there's a lot of logging that sustains wolves, you know, in that lower brush, young tree stage. So maybe the same wolf population statewide as we had back then, but they're all in one place, and they're all in northern Minnesota, as just about anybody can attest. They don't have to go very far to find a wolf track.
That's good. Bill, always a pleasure. Mark, thanks for organizing this. We are not done. Bill, you can count on coming back.
There's a lot more to cover on some of these other changes, like in other predator numbers and so forth. It'd be kind of fun to do it again.
All right.
Let's do it.
Let's do that then.
We'll plan on it.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
That's Mark.
Thanks, everybody. Yeah,
thanks.
Bye-bye. Yep.
Bill Berg, Mark Jacobs, you're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show.